From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made at a table. It's a long, solid oak table. It's a nice one, the kind you might find in a high-end hotel conference room. And at this table, there are a number of people sitting and debating. You've got members of the Rochester City School Board. You have state legislators, school principals. You might even have parents. But where are the students? You see, at this table, this is a discussion about how to fund schools and what exactly should be prioritized. And yet some Rochester students have come to wonder why just about everyone gets invited to this table for discussion except them. Well, this year they're attempting to change that. Students helped lead the calls for more in so-called foundation aid, more state money for districts like Rochester. And now it's actually happening. $84 million after a 14-year fight. In one sense, advocates and students feel like they have won, but they are not done here. Yes, the Rochester City School District is facing a large deficit that had grown problematic even before the pandemic, and some money is going to have to deal with deficits. But advocates say that even after filling the deficit, the RCSD should have millions of new dollars to work with. And so, Teens with Attitude, TWA, is a new youth coalition made up of several youth organizations, including Rock Responders, Teen Empowerment Youth Organizers, Youth Advocacy Committee, and Youth Build. Tomorrow, they'll roll out their ideas for how RCSD can make sure student voices are included this time, and how RCSD can understand what the biggest needs are. But first, they're with us on Connections, and I will welcome them now. Jasmine Gripper is Executive Director of the Alliance for Quality Education. Jasmine, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Seven Williams is a youth organizer at Teen Empowerment's West Side site and a freshman at School of the Arts. Seven, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me here.
And Joshua Carnes, a youth organizer at Teen Empowerment's East Side site and a freshman at School of the Arts. Joshua, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
In a moment, we expect your colleague Sarah Adams to join us, and we'll welcome her when she does. But I will just start by asking Jasmine if you agree with the critique here. We're going to be hearing from student voices. What do you make of the critique that for so long students feel left out of this process when, you know, when it's not just the adults? I mean, some students are adults, but really it's everyone else who's discussing how to spend school money. What do you think, Jasmine?
Well, students are the ones who attend the school, and they absolutely have a right to be decision makers and to be at the table when decisions are being made. Their voice is necessary, and they actually have really great ideas that need to be listened to and can transform the school from outside in. And it's absolutely essential that we uplift the youth voice, hear what their demands are, and then put them into action. The youth are our future. We have to give them a chance to lead now. And I am excited about what the youth are talking about right now and what they want to see in their schools. It's all the right things that schools should be doing in order to increase achievement and increase student engagement.
And we do have Sarah Adams, a student leader with the Youth Advisory Committee and freshman at East High School. Sarah, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Sarah, I'm going to ask you and your colleagues, the fellow students here, you know, how you feel about getting involved with such a difficult, often sort of sticky issue, school funding, money, et cetera. At your age, you're a freshman at East High School. Do you feel like, you know, you're ready to take on this challenge of sort of trying to help understand where the money goes and who decides?
I think for me, the way that I got involved, I really didn't have any choice because when I joined the fight, like, it was literally, like, fighting for our teachers. Like, we were literally losing teachers in the middle of the school year, and if we didn't do something, then we would have lost even more than we lost from the start. And I think it's amazing that we've, you know, gotten our foundation aid, but that doesn't change the fact that it's still a problem that we had to wait so long for it and that it took such dire situations for us to get it in the first place. And that's why I think that now that we have the chance to really, you know, turn things around, having all this money, all this one-time money and the foundation aid, we have to involve students and parents in the decisions, because if we look back in the past, there has not been very much student and parent engagement from the district, and, you know, they haven't been at the decision-making table, and I think that's where the issue is, because we know what's best for us, and it's always, oh, well, we can get input from them, you know, like, how is this going, or has this program been working? And I think that's ineffective when you could be doing something better by involving them from the start and having them be the ones creating the programs and telling, you know, the decision makers what should be in those programs, because we know what's going to help us the most and we know what's going to benefit us.
Well, and let me sort of explain a little bit more about what Sarah's talking about with getting involved for her when teachers are being cut, because I think the pandemic has stripped us of our sense of time. This feels like decades ago, but it wasn't. It was two Januaries ago, just a few months before the pandemic started. But, you know, December into January, the City of Rochester School District was laying off teachers in the middle of a school year. There were literally students leaving for holiday break in December, knowing they were going to be coming back to an entirely new teacher in January. And this was happening in dozens of classrooms. And the district was in a very hard spot. I mean, they were trying to balance budgets and deal with all kinds of holes. And I mean, this is back when Terry Dade was superintendent. It feels like forever ago, but it wasn't that long ago. And Sarah, it seems to me, tell me if I'm wrong here, it seems to me that what you're saying is you may say, people may say to the students on this panel today, hey, you're kids, be kids, let adults fight over things like budgets and priorities and money. But you felt like, look, I don't have that luxury right now. I'm losing my teacher. My friends are losing their teachers in the middle of a school year. And that's what sort of seems to have kickstarted your interest in your activism. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's nice to think that we can, you know, just be kids and just do what we want to do and live our lives as kids. But when you get put in these types of situations and you don't have all the right adults advocating for you and you don't have people trying to really make an effort to put you first and prioritize you, you have to step up because nobody else is.
Seven Williams, let me ask you a little bit about, you know, what you expect to happen next year. I mean, we know the money is there, and it seems to me that what tends to happen is once this money gets allocated, they can make decisions, whether it's the Rochester City School District, the New York State Education Department, they could do this pretty fast here. Are you concerned that the process is going to move too quickly without student voices, Seven?
Yes, I definitely think that they move very fast because most kids did not know about any of this that was going on. So I felt like they were just trying to move it past us, or like we don't look at it, we don't see the demands, so we don't know what they're putting inside the schools. I feel like they should have slowed it down because the social media does not show anything that's going on. I feel like they should have been more transparent, showing things that should have been done so we could know about it, because most people nowadays do not know about it. And that's what TWA is here for, so we can show and tell people what's going on.
Yeah, and Josh, can you tell me your thoughts about trying to bring more teenagers into this kind of a process? You know, I know that teen empowerment, part of what you do is engaging the community and getting people involved and trying to really kind of create positive change. But it can be tough to get teenagers really actively engaged with school budgets, money and funding and priorities. How do you see that? I mean, is this hard work? And what are you seeing so far, Josh?
Yeah, it's definitely not easy. You know, applying for teen empowerment, the reason that a lot of us got this job was because, you know, they thought that we would be ready as teenagers, you know, for the hard work, you know. Yeah, it's just things like that. It's definitely hard work. This isn't something normal that I think any teenager would think they'd be doing, you know, speaking or being advocates for their city, talking for their city about these big issues. So I definitely think that is something that's not the easiest. And bringing in teenagers, you know, around the city, we just have to let them know that this is something that's affecting us all, even if we're not seeing it. This is something that's affecting us because we're in the schools, you know, we're in the city, we're people too at the end of the day. We're not adults, but, you know, we are one of the most important factors having to do with things in the city.
And tell me if you can tell us a little bit, Josh, about what's coming up on May 8th. I see it's We Won, But We Ain't Done Youth Field Day at MLK Park. And from what I'm reading here, this is for youth by youth.
Yes, that is. Teen Empowerment and a couple other organizations, we're going to be putting together something at MLK Park. It's an event where we're going to be talking, doing pieces, you know, having a field day event, basically just bringing the community and the city together so our words can be heard. And, you know, everyone that isn't getting a chance to hear what we're talking about today or in other events can hear at MLK Park. So make sure everyone comes down on May 8th. Yeah.
Well, and in a moment, we're going to ask the students to be specific. We're going to talk about what their priorities, what TWA priorities might include if they have some success here. But let me ask Jasmine Gripper just a little bit more about this. You know, whenever we talk to youth advocates on a wide range of issues, Jasmine, it could be climate change. There's some amazing youth leaders in climate change that we've talked to over the years. I mean, I'm very impressed. But every time we do that, you know, I hear from some listeners who go, I do not want to take orders from teenagers. They should be growing up. They don't understand the world yet. You know, let them be students, let them grow into people, and then they can work for a while and then they can make decisions. We shouldn't be taking orders from them. There's some subset of the listening audience who always emails me and says that if we're talking climate change, other issues where kids are involved. So can you give me your sense, Jasmine, for the notion that, well, these are kids here. Why are they directing how we're going to create a multi-million dollar budget?
Schools are for our youth. They are for the students. Literally, they are the ones who go in the building every single day. They actually have the best analysis around what's happening in the schools than almost anyone else. And so they have a right to have a seat at the table. They are one of the biggest, they are literally the biggest stakeholders in our education schools. And so we need to prioritize what children have to say, how the schools make them feel, the outcomes that are happening and how we have those outcomes. Students have the solutions to those problems. And if we don't listen to them, then we're missing the whole point of education, which is that the students leave feeling prepared for life. And after talking to youth, you hear that our schools are failing to meet some of their basic needs. And they can tell you exactly how they're failing to meet the needs. And they also have some great solutions for how we can transform education. And so if you can argue about other areas that perhaps students, our children, youth shouldn't have as much say-so, but there's no way you can bring that argument into schools. Our kids have to have a seat at the table, especially when you're talking about youth who have taken the initiative to get involved in the advocacy to fight for these dollars. Rochester schools are expected to get $39 million in state dollars. They're also getting $284 million in federal dollars. That is a lot of money coming to the district. And yes, we want to talk to the chief financial officer. Yes, we want to hear from the school board. But we also, like Sarah said, we want to hear from parents and we want to hear from youth. And they absolutely deserve to be at the table to talk about how these dollars should be used for their own education.
So let's talk about what the Teens with Attitude priorities might include. And let me start with Sarah Adams. What's at the top of your list?
For me, I definitely think that training for teachers is one of the most important things. I think we need to make sure that we're training all teachers on all different areas, anti-racism, LGBTQ. There's so many different things that teachers need to be trained on because we know that the majority of the teachers are white, and white teachers just don't know how to connect, especially if they're from the suburbs. Majority of teachers that don't live in the city that are white, they don't know how to connect with students. And that's a huge issue because when you can't connect with your students, that affects their learning. That really affects their learning a lot. And I think that another big thing for me that needs to happen is we need to hire more black and brown teachers and put in teachers that students can relate to and build those connections with, young teachers as well. We need more young teachers. But then another thing for me, I struggle to explain this, but this most important to me would be diversifying the class selection. So if you look at the district's course catalog, there's a huge number of classes, and a lot of them look really good and actually are things that would benefit a lot of students. But if you're being real, when you look at the master class list or when you ask a student about the different classes that they take, that course catalog is not going to be reflected because, number one, people are not letting students know that these classes are available and really advocating for students to be able to take these classes. And number two, all schools don't offer the same classes. So, for example, at East we have the TLI program. I'm in that, and it's basically a CTE career pathway program where you basically gain leadership skills and you learn how to be a teacher. You gain skills on teaching and things like that. And East is the only school that offers that program, but now that we know how to work remotely, it shouldn't be that way, because I know that there's tons of kids who would benefit from a program like TLI, and that's just an example. There are so many different classes that you could talk about that students would benefit from that they're not available to take because of transportation issues or because they don't go to a certain school, and that can be changed. And I think that's something that should definitely happen.
Okay, and I want to press the point on training teachers before I talk to your peers about this. So you're certainly right. The majority of teachers are white. We know that in every school district in this listening area, every single one, teachers are disproportionately white. Suburb, city, et cetera. I mean, that's everywhere, vis-a-vis the population of the students that are being served. So when you say, generally speaking, that white teachers who tend to, you're right, not live in the district. In fact, we know the vast, vast majority of teachers do not live in the city of Rochester. So you say they tend to be white teachers, they tend to be from the suburbs, and they tend to really not know how to connect culturally. So let me ask you then, if you think that could change with the right training, is that something that is sort of inherent, that is not going to be changed with courses and training and leadership? Or can you have a majority white group of teachers and say, look, it's not ideal that we don't have it representative to the population. We're going to try to change that. But they're doing a good job. They've been trained. They know how to deal, be culturally responsive. Can that work, Sarah?
I think that course selection is definitely important, but you could be taking the most culturally relevant class in the course catalog. But if you don't have a good teacher, if you have a racist teacher who doesn't care about their students, who only works for the money, the class is not going to benefit the students at all. So I think it's got to be both. And I think ideally we want black and brown teachers. We want teachers that reflect the student body. But realistically, that's going to take a lot of time with seniority and, how teachers are protected and different things like that. So that's why I say we need to start with training, and training is definitely important. But eventually the goal is diversifying the teachers, completely, and having majority black and brown teachers, because those are the ones that the students are going to connect with the most.
Yeah, and Sarah, look, I know this is a complex issue, bringing more teachers of color to the profession. 5 years ago, WXXI, we did a year-long reporting investigation and looking at the number, and really the small number of teachers of color in every district in Monroe County. And 5 years later, we're going to do it again, and we're going to see if anything much has changed. But every district will tell you, we care about this, we're trying. I'm not going to ask you to figure out exactly how to do it, but I do want to ask you what would change the ideas of you and your peers about wanting to become teachers. What will convince more black and brown students to want to become teachers?
Seeing black and brown teachers in the school. So I think there's a lot of black and brown teachers out there. I just think that there's definitely not enough, but I think we just need to start hiring them. And it's programs like TLI that are going to make students my age and students want to become teachers. Because, for me, I have always been interested in, I've always thought that I wanted to do something, in the education path. But, TLI gives, literally, students get the opportunity to go into classrooms and actually be a student student teacher, with the students in the schools. And I think we just need more programs like that. And, I think TLI is one of the best ways in the district that we've been, encouraging more black and brown people mm-hmm. to be teachers.
Yep. Seven Williams, what
I
would...
think, can I...
Oh, yeah. I think that's just...
Go ahead. Yep. To that a little bit there.
Yeah.
Is that we need to do both. We need to train the teachers in the cohorts we currently have, and we also need to do a good job of recruiting a more diverse group of teachers. There are really successful Grow Your Own programs where districts are investing in high school students now and taking them through college, and they come back to the district to teach, that we can really do and get it right. We can go to HBCUs and recruit teachers to come back to our districts. But the other thing is not just recruiting the teachers, it's the retention. Black teachers come in and they don't stay because they don't feel welcomed, right? How are they pushed out? How are we actually recruiting them and retaining them in the district? That's really important in order to have a comprehensive solution to this problem.
Okay, and Seven, let me also ask you and Josh, if I could. You know, Seven, when you think about your peers who are your age, are there many at all who think, well, in the future, I want to be a teacher? And what might change that?
From knowing all my friends, I haven't heard one of my friends, not one, even say or think about being a teacher. And that really shows that, like, there's not a lot of black teachers. Like, none of them wants to be a teacher. It's like, why would we want to be a teacher? Yeah, y'all hire black teachers, but then the next minute, they fire. So it's like, I'm about to go to college through all this time and try to be a teacher in a white-based job. Like, how do y'all want that to work? And I feel like it's a lot of white teachers, so we just don't comprehend. And none of my friends want to be teachers, so I can honestly say I haven't heard no kid ever say they wanted to be a teacher, not one black kid.
Wow. Josh, what about you?
I have heard a few of my friends say that they want to be teachers. Not like, you know, regular school teachers, but teachers of other things, music or sports. Those are coaches, I guess you would call it, but it's still a teacher in a sense. But something that I think, you know, changes why people want to be teachers or don't want to be teachers anymore is just, you know, looking at everything that's going on in this world. You know, it's not simple, but the coronavirus, you know, something as simple as that just makes people lose their jobs. And now teachers, they're looking for new jobs. OK, or you're looking at how students teach, treat the teachers and how stressed out they get, or how much money teachers have to spend on, you know, things that aren't necessities, but things that they use to keep their children happy, like pizza parties or, you know, things like that. Just, you know, certain aspects of that just turns a kid off from being a teacher. You know, it just makes it seem like teaching is just one of the most stressful jobs ever. And, you know, teaching is stressful to a point, but it shouldn't be as stressful as it is in this day and age.
Talking to a group of students who are part of a coalition that is seeking to put some pressure on the Rochester City School District and decision makers about a big pot of new money. I would say new money, really it's old money that the district finally won, $84 million after a 14-year fight for the foundation aid that New York State promised back in around 2006, 2007. So these students have come together, different organizations have come together, and they have put together this list of priorities. And Jasmine Gripper, you hear them talk about the impact of not seeing black and brown teachers, of not having culturally sort of responsive either curriculum or just relationships. How realistic do you think it is to prioritize that in the way that will get, you know, that will produce results decently quickly?
It's absolutely realistic. The what these students are asking for are what districts across the country and across New York State are grappling with right now. New York City is trying to figure out how they're going to roll out a culturally responsive and sustaining curriculum, and how they're going to, and they are rolling out a program to train their teachers in anti-racism and anti-bias training. We literally see districts across the state and across the country that are grappling with these problems in real time, and we can learn from them. And Rochester could also lead in this field. There's a lot of expertise in Rochester City, in the city, within the school district. And it's time that we just make this a priority. We know every year that budgets are about priorities. Now that the money is there, what is the district going to prioritize? And the things that the youth are identifying right now are concrete things that can be tackled immediately. We can think about how we're going to, we know the benefits of it. The research shows that when kids see themselves reflected in the classroom, when they see teachers that look like them, when teachers have high expectations of them, they do substantially better. And so literally, we just need to put research and practice into action and prioritize this in the budget and prioritize this in the policies that are going to come forth. And we can get this done, and we can get this done right this year. We probably can't do all of it, but we can get on the right direction and start implementing these programs literally immediately. And I think the city and the schools will see a huge benefit once we start. And the fact that the students are naming what research shows is a proven to work way of transforming schools and school climate just shows that students, again, need to be at the table and need to be helping in the decision-making process.
Jasmine, I don't know what the superintendent of RCSD and other leaders might say to this, but do you have a sense that there is a chance that the students can really make a dent here this year with this?
You know, one of my glimmers of hope is that former Rochester school staff, Ruth Turner, is now on the New York State Board of Regents. And if folks remember, before she became a regent in New York State, she was really leading school climate transformation in Rochester. And so I think the district has done some good things already. And the students are just saying, let's take those steps in a bigger direction. Let's ramp that up. I think we can get there. You know, there's been a revolving door of staff in Rochester, which makes it hard to have, you know, programs continue and grow. But I think, you know, one thing that's not a revolving door is the students are there. The parents are still in the community, and we really need to listen to them. And if parents and students are saying this is a priority, then the district needs to make it a priority. If it wasn't before, it needs to be now.
We're going to, in our second half hour, get to more of the students' specifics that they are hoping and pushing to get prioritized with this funding. But let me grab a phone call, if I could, because I want to stick on the subject here of recruiting teachers before we move on from that. And it's Carmen in Rochester. Go ahead, Carmen.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because I'm a product of City School District, graduated in 1975, so that tells you a little bit of my age. Don't laugh, I'm old. Well, anyway, I loved going into the City School District. I was inspired as an immigrant to learn English, to do the best I could, and so forth. And I had some black teachers, brown teachers, my art teacher. I mean, he happened to be from the South. And I had another teacher, Mrs. Jones, who we all loved, and so forth. And, yes, there aren't enough. And as a person, you know, Hispanic but white, I can tell you that we definitely need more teachers of all types, Asian, Native American, and so forth. And I've taught in D.C. in charter schools. I've taught in Florida. I've taught in Monroe County schools, and I've been adjunct at a college here. And one of the things I did, I didn't start off in teaching. I started off in a different field. And when I did my co-ops at RIT, I was paid during the summer co-ops. Teachers are not paid to do their internship, their student teaching, if you will. And they should get paid for that. Instead, teachers are charged tuition, which is very different, and I find that very unfair. So you have to pay tuition while you're not studying, but student teaching, and you don't get paid for student teaching like when I did a co-op to work in a business and got paid all summer and get my degree, my first degree. So my master's is in teaching with certifications through SUNY Brockport and Nazareth College in teacher education, you know, K-12, and then I taught in college with my master's degree from Middlebury College. So I think that's one idea is why aren't student teachers being paid for their internships? Their internships should be longer, like in Germany. They have a teacher work with a master teacher for 2 years, and typically they have 2 certifications. And they get paid. They get paid and work with a master teacher so that you don't have this quick leave of young teachers before they get their 5-year master's degree. You must have a master's degree within 5 years of graduating in order to keep your job in New York State, which is really ridiculous because you can teach in college without certification, but you can't teach kindergarten without certification. So we need to relax some laws and some restrictions to allow more people to get into teaching and then let them try. They do their 2-year internship, they get paid, and then they say, well, you know what? Before I go on to my master's, I don't really think this is for me. Or they're going to love it and pursue it. And the other thing is I applied and I had Paul Douglas scholarships, governor scholarships for being in the top 10. Many students don't know if you graduate in the top 10 in city schools, you could apply for specific scholarships that pay almost all of your, if not all, of your tuition, books, and all that And so more students need to understand they can go into teaching and help, get the help that's out there. And then finally, the other thing is I was also given an opportunity to teach in a school that had a high need of teachers and critically short. And I applied there. So for every year I taught there, I was credited with student loan credits that alleviated some of my student loans. So that's out there too. And maybe we can do that for, you know, all of the teachers, for all of their student loans, or at least give 0%. If banks could get big buyouts and sellouts and what have you and pay very little, why can't student teachers get grants and loans to get them through college, to get into teaching? And remember, it takes a couple generations to get into college. If your parents didn't go to college, you know, it's very difficult to be first-generation college like I was. I was first-generation college. My mom was terribly proud of me, incredibly proud of me. She's long passed, but I taught, and she would always tell everybody, my daughter's a teacher, my daughter's a teacher. She loved the fact that I became a teacher like some other members in Europe. But here in New York, I was the only family member to get a master's degree and teach. So those are my ideas as a student of city schools, as a teacher in city schools here and in D.C. charter schools. And I've taught where I've been the minority. Okay. 80% of my students were of color. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with the color of a teacher and the color of a student. What is wrong is it's disproportionate. We need more balance. We need students to be balanced and integrated. And we need teachers to have a balance and have a variety of teachers that someone could say, oh, look, I'm Asian. That's an Asian teacher. And could identify and be inspired and aspire to be the first generation in their family or another generation to go to college and look into teaching. And teaching isn't the end of it. You can go into teaching.
Yeah, Carmen, I've got to jump in here just because I don't want to lose time here, and there's other issues we got to get to. But Jasmine, you want to share some thoughts on what you just heard there? Go ahead.
I think she did identify some things that New York needs to work on, which is the stringent requirements of how hard it is to become a teacher, and that not getting paid during an internship is shown to be a barrier for people of color and people in poverty. Like, mm-hmm. you need paid internships because people need money. And so I think that's right. There are barriers that we need to address. Again, that's not just a local problem. That is a state problem that New York has. But we need to work on it in order to improve the teacher diversity across the state.
After we take this only break, we're going to come back and ask the students on our panel what else is on their list of priorities as Rochester, as a district, works with new funding that should have been old funding. Foundation aid, about $84 million, and the students are part of a coalition that is asking the district to prioritize the thoughts, the opinions, and the priorities of students who are in the schools now. Sarah Adams is a student leader with the Youth Advisory Committee, freshman at East High School. Josh Carnes is a youth organizer at Teen Empowerment's East Side site and a freshman at School of the Arts. Seven Williams is a youth organizer at Teen Empowerment's West Side site and a freshman at School of the Arts. Jasmine Gripper, also with us, executive director of the Alliance for Quality Education. And we're right back with the student priorities next. Coming up in our second hour, mental health at work. Are employers supporting their employees' needs? Where do lines get drawn? What's appropriate? What does PPE look like? PPE during the pandemic, we know what that is. What does PPE look like from a mental health perspective in the workplace? These are new questions many employers are considering, and we will address them next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So let's continue with the question of these priorities, and I want to ask about an issue that has been in the news, especially in this pandemic and this school year, and that's food. Seven Williams, can you tell me about what you think should be prioritized with this funding when it comes to how students are fed?
When it comes to food, I think it should be totally different. The food is like jail food. Why would you want to send your child to school to get food that's at like jail food? Most kids go to school just to get the food, and most kids can't bring it. Kids go throughout the whole day without eating. Go to lunch and have to eat jail food? Nah, that's not right. Most teachers wouldn't even eat the food. They say it themselves. So why would you
give it to us to eat. That's like you going throughout the day. They want us to be paying attention on an empty stomach. I feel like all that money we should have, it should be hot food, different type of options. We don't have no options. It's only one thing and one thing only.
Okay. And when it comes to food and funding, Jasmine Gripper, does this seem realistic, a change that can be made quickly?
Yeah, we've seen districts in New York State develop a better farm-to-table program. We have lots of farms here in New York State. We have our local farmers who we want to support. We can think about how the district can partner with local farms to get fresh food in our classrooms. I think the point that Seven is making makes sense. When you are not eating the right food, you don't have the energy to sustain in your day. And imagine kids going the entire school day with no food. We need to do better, and we need to increase the food options that kids are having, healthy food options, and options that we as adults should eat. There was a video or a picture on social media from this summer or this school year where there was the food was moldy in Rochester schools. That's completely unacceptable that we're serving students food that none of us would ever want to eat. We have to do a better job of giving our kids healthy foods, giving them options that make them feel good, energizes their body, and gets them ready for learning.
Let me ask Josh Carnes, if I could, about another priority that I'm seeing on the list here from these student organizations, and that is to hire and expand caring and social-emotional supports and support staff in schools. What do you think, Josh?
I think that's definitely a need. What I notice is that the only time you have a counselor, really, is just when you're in high school. And if we're talking about just throughout the whole RCSD, you know, there's a lot of other grades other than 9th through 12th. So, and with the counselors too, we only have one counselor, you know, per letter. You got one counselor, then you got another counselor for the other half of the alphabet. That's not enough to me. You know, that's one person trying to deal with a lot of kids and their mental problems and the other problems that they go through school. And that's not fair to them. Like, it's not fair to us because we want someone's full attention and we want to know that we have someone's just time, you know, and someone that actually cares about us. Because we can have a counselor, someone there, but that doesn't, you know, exactly mean that they care about what, you know, we're saying specifically. That just means that they're there to do their job. You know, if I actually had someone there that I could relate to and know, you know, has either been through the same experience or can relate to just something that I've been through in anything that I'm saying, it'd make me feel a lot more safe and a lot more at home in my school environment.
Sarah Adams, how do you feel about that?
I agree. I think mental health is one of the biggest things that we also need to talk about. I think that with the pandemic and with everything, there's just so much. Like, you could talk about the things that all the youth in the city have gone through, and like the list could go on and on and on forever, talking about the different things that we have seen, the different things that we've gone through, and there's not enough support for that. A lot of students definitely don't get that at home. And I think school is one of the one places that we go to try and, you know, escape everything that, you know, goes on outside of school. And I think that it's so difficult when you don't have the right support there, when you don't have adults that you feel comfortable talking to, you don't have people in rooms that you feel like you walk into and you can let your guard down. So I think the district really needs to step the game up when it comes to that, when it comes to mental health. And I think another thing when we talk about mental health is a restorative aspect. I think the removing police from schools was a huge step towards that, and it was an amazing thing, and I will always talk about that win. But I think the SSOs is, like, something that you can talk about when you look at restorative things, because I know for me, I know all my SSOs' names. They know my name. I feel comfortable with them, and, you know, those are people who we can actually talk to, and I think they're from the community, they're Black and brown, and that's a perfect example of why we need more Black and brown staff in general.
And Seven, what do you think about that?
From going to SOTA, there is no Black social workers or anything like that. My counselor is great, but she don't understand where I come from. Like, she don't live in a city with us, so it's like once she go home and I go home, it's two different things. At night, I can hear gunshots. At night, she don't hear anything. So it's coming from two perspectives. How you going to help me out if you don't understand what I'm going through? Yeah, you went to college and read all the books, but that can't really teach you what they really know. Like, it don't show what we go through. Like, you don't know the pain of being beaten, hurt, or even being raped at all. I know white people go through stuff too, but it's different. You living in the suburbs, it's not the same thing as the city. I really feel like if we had them, kids would be open, wanting to talk to people. Most people don't go to their social workers and stuff because the first thing they're going to want to do is go to the police. Most kids don't want to bring the police to their own home because they're going to get in trouble by their parents. If we can't go to school and talk to somebody, all our feelings is balled up inside. How do you want us to learn about something if we can't even talk to our counselors and express our feelings? Most kids go to school to have that one meal that day, and that's it. They can't talk to the counselor. So it's like, what's the point of even going to school? That's why most kids don't go to school at all. It's like, I'm going to school. It's nothing they really teaching me because I really don't care about what they're teaching me because it's not influencing me. Mm.
And Jasmine Gripper, Executive Director of the Alliance for Quality Education, this is another suggestion that you find within reach here.
Absolutely. I think this is what this pandemic has been, a huge mental health crisis. It is stressful for us as adults. It is even more stressful for students and youth who rely on routines and things that they can depend on. And for our routines to be abruptly disrupted is a huge barrier, and to be taken out of all social settings and not to be able to congregate with friends. And we are used to being in community and being with people on a regular basis, to have lost so many loved ones from the pandemic and from other violence that we see in our community. This is traumatizing. And we can't, like, I think literally what everyone on the call just said, just really puts it so clear in perspective how much this is needed. Youth need someone to talk to. I applaud these youth for being able to clearly say what they need. They need counselors. And that does not look like police officers. They need someone to talk to when they are stressed out. They need someone who understands what they're dealing with and wants to listen and wants to provide them with resources and tools. How do you calm down? How do you deal with your anger? You know, what do you do when you're really stressed out? This has to be prioritized because we can't even get to any learning if your youth is not in a place to learn, if they are balled up with emotion. And then you just have classroom outbursts and you have disruptions and you wonder why kids aren't sitting still and why they're not learning. They're not in a place to learn yet. And so social emotional supports have to be prioritized. They were needed before. They're needed even more now because of this pandemic and what it's done to our community.
Let me grab a couple of phone calls. Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
Good, sir.
This is a great show. And in talking to the food issue, I think this is one of the failures of outsourcing. As we outsource, when a company is trying to make profit, i.e. the Aramark and all these other companies, where they're cutting is in the, not only in the employees, but they're cutting in the quality of the food. They're trying to gain efficiency, but the reality is the quality of the food is going down, and all they have to deal with is the nutritional numbers. Forget it. And to these children are nothing but a number to these companies. And this is what happens when you outsource, because outsourcing is a huge failure in government. As much as quiet as it's kept, it's a huge failure. And this is a perfect example of putting a profit margin in on our children, because that company is trying to make a profit. As long as the number of carbs and the number of proteins are in that food, the taste, the presentation is unimportant to them. And this is, and especially when you're talking about black and brown kids.
Rich, thank you. And on the subject of exactly that, let me grab Eamon in Rochester, who wants to maybe elaborate there. Go ahead, Eamon.
Yeah, thanks, Evan, for having me. And thanks to all the students for coming on. We really need to listen to them when we think about solutions for this huge amount of money that the school district is getting, and really all school districts across the state. So about food, you know, there are a lot of things that the district Rochester City School District could do. And I just wanted to add, you know, this wouldn't cost that much. The real problem we've had for years with school meals is that it's driven by the reimbursement from the federal government. And it's so low that you're often spending only a little over a dollar on meals for kids. And so just putting a few million more dollars of that hundreds of millions in federal aid towards school meals could have farm-to-table options. We could have more produce coming from local farmers, better, healthier options. Do simple things like make sure that every school has a salad bar so you have a place to stock that food. Have flavor stations just to make the food more palatable. And also work with the students around what the meal ideas are. You know, what are the culturally relevant meal options for kids? What are the things they actually want to eat? Again, it's not that expensive, but for a school district that has struggled with budgets for so many years and is always looking to cut, it's the last thing that's invested in, and right now it should be one of the first things. And just one more thing I'd like to say, you know, about school climate, that should be a huge priority of the district. I know the district has committed to restorative practices, help zones, reducing suspensions, and now that there are hundreds of millions of dollars, there's really no excuse not to scale up that work. But thanks again.
Yeah, thank you, Eamon. I appreciate it, calling from the Children's Agenda. One more phone call on the subject of food, and we'll keep it tight. Peter in Hammondsport. Go ahead, Peter.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. Just wanted to comment because I used to be a vegetable farmer and just want to share my experience with trying to work with the school. I think it's really important that kids should have access to clean food, but the attitudes around food, in my opinion, need to change because the school first reached out looking for food to be donated, as in, you know, farmers can work for free, and then what they were willing to pay just wasn't, you know, not profitable for me as a farmer. So I just wanted to share that and say I think it's, I think part of the school budget should be, you know, paying farmers a living wage too, or a potential allocation of funds could be if a county or a school district actually had their own, you know, farmer who grew everything and everything went to the school. And you could pay a farmer a living wage and all food could be just donated straight to the school. But, you know, I actually had to stop farming out where I am because I just couldn't make a living doing it. People just don't want to pay for organic vegetables out in the country. But, yeah, just wanted to share that and say people need to actually acknowledge that, you know, food isn't cheap and, you know, actually good food isn't cheap. And, you know, a big difference can be made in the life of the farmer and the life of the students if a real value is actually attached to the food that's being sourced.
Peter, thank you for that. And look, I mean, I'm sure the broader question of what schools in general are spending food money on and where it goes and whether it pays living wages and what the quality is and if it's locally sourced or not. I mean, that's probably a whole other conversation and it's really valuable. And I'm glad Peter called to say that. But let me just kind of put a fine point on this. As complex as this is, you cannot look at the quality of the food that some students get in certain districts, Rochester included, versus others, and say that it is satisfactory. I mean, listen to what the students are saying. Seven Williams described it as jail food. I mean, that's really rough. So we will see if this money brings some change. And in the last couple of minutes, Sarah Adams, maybe 30 or 40 seconds, some final thoughts from you about what happens next here. How are you going to try to get this all done, Sarah?
I think we just really need to take a step back and slow down and realize that we just found out that we're getting all this money coming in. I think things are moving really, really fast for the seriousness of the issue and how, you know, because this stuff is going to impact long-term, like really long-term, the stuff that's happening. So I think we need to slow down and really figure out how we're going to bring the students to the table and how we're going to bring the parents to the table and allow them to make the programs, make the decisions, help create the things that are, you know, best needed for us and what's going to help us the most. Because like I said in the beginning, we know what's best for us.
Okay. Seven Williams, same question for you, about 30 seconds. What's next here?
I definitely feel like the first thing they should definitely work on is food because that's like the most not expensive thing. So it will help and benefit everything. And I feel like when they hire a new teacher, you can't teach white people how to not be racist. You can't tell somebody don't be racist to these kids. So it's like you can't really teach people that stuff. So hiring different culturally diverse staff will just help out the whole community. Because if you around somebody that's giving that good energy, you're going to get that good energy too. So I feel like if white people is around more black people, they will know how to treat us and how we feel being around them.
Okay, and Josh Carnes, final thoughts, 30 seconds. Go ahead, Josh.
Final thoughts just on this whole situation. I just think that teenagers need more of a word in this, and I think that if our voices are being heard, like you say it is, it just needs to be put into action, you know, actually, you know, be put out there. Thank you for this.
I appreciate all of you. And Jasmine Gripper, final word from you. Are you confident?
Yeah,
are you confident, Jasmine? Go ahead.
Yeah, Rochester City School District has a lot of work to do. They have to get their finances back on track, but they really need to listen to parents and students. Students are clear. They need culturally responsive education. They need supports, counselors, not cops. They need food and healthy food options in their schools. This does not seem like a hard list of things to get done, but they need to be prioritized and it needs to happen quickly. And like Sarah said, let's not rush the process. Let's talk to parents and students so we can get it right.
Well, our community is going to be hearing more about TWA, Teens with Attitude, this coalition of groups working together on this, and we're glad to have them first right here on Connections. And let me thank them. Sarah Adams, thanks for taking the time. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Josh Carnes, same. Thank you very much, Josh.
Thank you.
Seven Williams, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me here.
And Jasmine Gripper, Executive Director of the Alliance for Quality Education. Thank you, Jasmine.
It was a pleasure.
More Connections in a moment.